I see the pictures broadcasted from Iraq, how they do the house-to-house search, the aggression in the face, how they get in the houses. For a moment, I don't know if it's in the West Bank or if it's in Iraq. It's the same pictures. You can never tell. For some seconds, you can never tell. They've been doing this for many years. They've been doing it since the 70s, what they're doing.
The plan for Iraq is to be like Palestine.
I see pictures broadcasted from Iraq, how they do the house-to-house search, the aggression in the face, how they get in the houses. For a moment, I don't know if it's in the West Bank or if it's in Iraq. It's the same pictures. You can never tell. For some seconds, you can never tell. House-to-house search. House-to-house search. I see pictures broadcasted from Iraq. House-to-house search. For a moment, I don't know if it's in the West Bank or if it's in Iraq. House-to-house search. They've been doing it since the 70s, is what they're doing.
The plan for Iraq is to be like Palestine. The plan for Iraq is to be like Palestine.
House-to-house search.
With Ken Barney. His daughter Susan Barney was arrested here in the village of Jayus, or near to it anyway, by the gate. Why don't you tell us first of all about the action that they conducted?
A large group of Palestinians from the village, plus the internationals, a group of internationals, about 20 or so, plus some Israeli peace activists planned to protest nonviolently the building of this wall. And one morning, this is about a year ago, they went over there and confronted the bulldozer operator who was about to start doing his work. He stopped the bulldozer and waited a while and then turned around and left. And it was a big victory. They went back to the village and had a celebration. And then the following day, they planned to repeat the same action. And of course, they knew that the following day they probably were going to encounter the Israeli military. And in fact, that's what happened when they arrived and did the same thing, tried to prevent the bulldozers from doing their work. This was at a distance. They weren't right in front of the bulldozers. The Israeli military, they could see them coming in the distance. And when they arrived, they said this is a closed military zone, and they had to leave. And also at the same time, they were interfering with the Palestinians who were in a field nearby doing their morning prayers. Well, the internationals, there were 9 internationals plus 1 Israeli peace activist that had been prepared to resist nonviolently, and they were prepared to be arrested, and that's exactly what happened. It was a very rough arrest. I was back home. Several hours later, received a phone call from Susan, who still had her cell phone. My daughter said that they were in the Ariel police station. They had been arrested. She told me a little bit about it. She said she couldn't really tell me very much about it at the time. She was trying to hide this conversation from the Israeli police. They had been taken to the settlement, to the police station there. There were essentially 10 of them taken, but they very quickly released the Israeli peace activists, leaving the 9 internationals. 2 of them were quickly released when they agreed to leave the country, signed some papers. This was an Irish woman and Thomas Linner, the Canadian, who they were kind of worried about, because during the melee, when the Israeli military went after them, he was butted in the stomach, and they were worried that he was injured. Esther, Sarah from Barcelona, was also roughed up quite a bit, but had a lot of bruises and scratches, but she was not really badly injured. So this left 7 of them, who then spent a total of 3 days before they had deportation hearings. They spent almost a day hanging around, being detained in the police station in Ariel, and then they were sent to the prison in Tel Aviv, the one that's near, I forgot the name of it, it's near Ben Gurion Airport, where they awaited their deportation hearings. Fortunately, the 3 women had the services of this Israeli lawyer, Shammai Leibowitz, who incidentally is a refusenik himself and the grandson of a very famous Israeli philosopher who many, many years ago was extremely critical of Zionism and what Israel was doing. He was pretty notorious, but also well-respected. Shammai Leibowitz somehow arranged quickly to have the deportation hearing for the women shifted to the Israeli Supreme Court, there was one judge that heard the case, and this judge decided against the military and in favor of the internationals, and so they were not deported. And the next day, because the precedent had been set that day with the three women, the four men who were left, they had their hearing, and they also won their hearing. So these seven of the original nine internationals, as I said, two of them had just left early voluntarily. Not exactly voluntarily. So the seven of them were not deported. They essentially won the hearing. And most of them left, but had been planning to leave anyway and return to their home countries. One of them, Radhika, from Southern California, stayed on. And she's actually stayed for many months to continue to work here in Palestine.
We are joined by Radhika Sainath. Radhika, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And you've got quite a story to tell us. Talk to us about how you first became interested in what's happening in the occupied territories.
Well, I've been involved for a long time in human rights issues, mostly in Latin America, and labor issues in the United States and Canada. And my interest in what's happening in Palestine stemmed out of that, and I decided to go join the International Solidarity Movement to support Palestinian nonviolent resistance to the occupation about a year ago.
And I know that you are currently involved in a lawsuit against the Israeli government for violating your rights when you were arrested. This lawsuit stems out of a peaceful protest that you attended. Can you talk to us about some of the facts surrounding this protest and your subsequent arrest?
Sure. I was arrested last November, or November 2002, while participating in a nonviolent peaceful protest in the West Bank village called Jayus, which included Palestinian, Israeli, and international nonviolent human rights activists. And that day, about 250 of us marched down to the site where the apartheid wall was being constructed, and hundreds of olive trees were being uprooted. And when we reached the area where the bulldozing was occurring, we were stopped by the army, the Israeli army, which allowed us to proceed. And it was a Friday, which is the holy day for Muslims. And the Palestinians decided to pray on the land where the olive trees were being uprooted. Shortly after prayer finished, the army commander gave us 10 minutes to disperse, or he threatened to use violence. However, as the crowd was dispersing and prior to the 10 minutes finishing, the army reacted with violence, firing tear gas, percussion grenades, rubber-coated steel bullets, and live ammunition. And during this time, 10 human rights activists were arrested, 9 internationals and 1 Israeli, and I was one of those.
With me on the line, News Director M.T. Karthik. Karthik, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Can you tell me a little bit about how you see the international situation in the occupied territories?
The Oslo process, it has broken down completely. And as a result, people are very suspicious of initiatives or proposals that are coming from outside of the region. And there is a feeling that the Geneva Accords, like everything else, do not take into consideration enough of what is happening here. The right of return is very serious, and the Geneva Accords seem to talk about this being something that can be dispensed with now that the diaspora of Palestinians has grown so large and it has spread around the world. Many people, I think, are very upset about the fact that right of return is being dismissed, or that that's going to be the new beginning point for discussion. As far as internationals on the ground here, there are a lot of people who are now participating with the Palestinians here on the ground. The international solidarity movement is present, and you can see them in actions that are taking place in and around the city of Jerusalem, and in villages there are demonstrations, nonviolent marches. It's pretty interesting what is happening. There were two villagers who were telling us that they participated with a group of internationals in a protest against the wall, and they were describing the nonviolent tactics, and the villagers were keying on how this was new for them. To use a nonviolent method was new for them as a means of communicating the situation on the ground here, and to show that it's the Israelis who are using force and not the Palestinians in that particular demonstration.
What's being proposed by the Palestinians in terms of the right to return?
I think that one of the big issues is that the Palestinians have been saying, you know, a couple of different people here, for example, I asked a couple of times, I said, well, wait a minute, you know, we keep talking about Madrid, Oslo, you know, these different accords that are coming from outside of the region, and the Palestinians are never happy with them. And of course, the Israelis are getting a tremendous amount of mileage out of that. They go around saying, see, you can't deal with these people. You can't talk to them. They're unwilling to compromise. But what the Palestinians are saying to a person as I go around and discuss with them, and I'm talking about people who work in NGOs here, I'm talking about people who are involved with social services, people who are just, you know, trying to make some kind of life under these conditions, which must be called, I think, apartheid conditions at this point. That's the reality. When you talk to them, what they say is, wait a minute, we've made our proposal. It's very specific. It's been specific since 1967, and there's been a continuous encroachment upon what our proposal is. Our proposal is the Green Line. Our proposal is the 22% at least. And our proposal is the right of return of the Palestinian refugees who were displaced by the violence of the Israeli military in 1967 and in 1948. They are very clear about what it is that they want, and they say that their proposal has been up, but it has never been given credence. Instead, people seem to walk away from it saying that it's something that can never happen, it's something that shouldn't be discussed. The Israelis, of course, do not even recognize the refugees, and more they're trying to erase words that the Palestinians have been trying to maintain, which are validated by the conditions on the ground, words like occupation, words like refugee. And the Palestinians feel disrespected. They feel even these European proposals and these proposals by, you know, well-intentioned Palestinian intellectuals who are living outside of the region do not take into consideration that they have been asking for some very simple things in very simple terms for a very long time, which have not been addressed.
I am joined in studio by Radhika Sainath of the International Solidarity Movement. Radhika, I'm sure that a lot of what you heard sounds pretty familiar. Were you ever in a situation where the media was present, and were the forces acting a little different than they normally would?
Undoubtedly. I was at many nonviolent demonstrations where once cameras arrived, the army started behaving differently. I remember the very first day that I arrived into the West Bank, I noticed that it was when bulldozers started uprooting olive trees for the apartheid wall in one village, and a Palestinian family was very upset to see their trees being destroyed, ran down to the area, and a border policeman arrived, pointed his gun at one of the sons, and we thought that he was going to shoot him, and started taking pictures and videotaping what was happening, and there was this dramatic change in behavior. So it's very true that media and an international presence can play a de-escalating role.
Can you talk to us a little bit about these apartheid conditions?
Well, it's what the wall is doing right now, especially in the area where I was in the northern West Bank, where the wall has been completed, is in fact turning villages into prisons and cities into ghettos. For example, there's one village called Jabara, which is located on the Israeli side of the wall. It's a tiny village of about 300 people, and it has no elementary school. And all of the children go to a neighboring village about, before the wall was built, 10 minutes away for school. Currently, they have to pass through a gate in the wall every morning and every afternoon, manned by Israeli soldiers with M16s. And whenever there's a holiday in Israel or perhaps an emergency somewhere else, soldiers arrive late or sometimes not at all. And in the fall, we visited the children and they were, you know, had to wait hours in the scalding heat. And now it's winter and the conditions are raining and cold, and the children still have to wait. So the conditions are appalling. I mean, in what country in the world do children have to pass through checkpoints, you know, manned by soldiers in order to get to school?
Talk to us about your current lawsuit against the State of Israel.
Well, I I decided to sue the Israeli government after my arrest last year, because of the treatment that I received, where I was the authorities had a hearing and I was not allowed to call my lawyer, nor was my lawyer informed, and I was driven. I was taken to many different locations, not told why I was arrested, why I was being held, and there was a complete breach in law. And so I sued the Israeli government, and I testified December 4th about my unlawful arrest. And after I testified, I was followed by undercover plainclothes policemen. I, along with six other Israeli and international friends, upon leaving the courthouse, boarded a bus, at which point plainclothes officers that were on the bus approached me and told me that I would have to come with them, that I was violating the law. I was not allowed to communicate with my friends, who I asked to call my lawyer. They shoved me in a unmarked white police van, took me to a detention center, and told me there that they were going to take me to prison and then deport me. And I am without a doubt that this is a vindictive measure for deciding to pursue a lawsuit against an illegal arrest. If I had been breaking the law, as the Israeli authorities had stated, there is no reason why they could not have come with regular policemen in a marked police vehicle, as opposed to pursuing such elaborate tactics of fear and intimidation. And I think that this is another measure of the Israeli state's treatment and harassment of human rights workers who are there to document the atrocities and the human rights abuses of Palestinians in the occupied territories. After I was arrested, I was taken to an airport cell. Even though my lawyer had received orders from a judge stating that I should be taken to my hearing, and the judge was appalled that I was treated in such a way, the police decided to not comply with the orders, take me to an airport cell, where I was held for a total of 50 hours. In the end, I was allowed to be released and remained under house arrest for about 5 days until I returned back to the United States last Friday.
When kids are arrested in the street, there is a detention period of 8 days or 12 days. These 8 days, Israeli army have the right to arrest you even if you was in the street, not throwing stone, just walking in the street, or they can come to your house, arrest you, and keep you for this 8 or 12 days. It's detention, and it's no charges. During these 8 days, you might be released, or then after it, the 8 days, you might be sent to interrogation center, or they might have an administrative detention order for you. But many kids are arrested for these 8 days and released, and they're not registered in any association. So on a daily basis, there is kids who are arrested and released and kept in these detention centers, or sent to interrogation center or detention camp, administrative detention camp. They're interrogated and they're beaten up and they're threatened, because when you talk with an interrogator with an adult and threaten him, as an adult, you would know how to protect yourself and keep your, you know, what you should say and what you shouldn't and what will harm you. But for the kid, when he say, listen, you will be kept here forever, and he's 13, he's not that mature to think, no, he's threatening me. So he would say, yes, I was with this and that, and he would give other names. And sometimes he would say, I did things, and he didn't do it, because they just want to leave the room of interrogation and go back to the cell with his friend.
Are girls among these 350 children and others being taken in 4 days and 6 days as well?
Yes, there is girls, but the girls are sent to Neve Tirza, which is specially for women. And in the same prison itself, there is an Israeli criminal prisoners. They're kept in the same prison, but different section. So these young women are also sent to interrogation in the Maskubiye or in other interrogation sectors, and then moved to Ramle to spend their administrative detention or their sentence. Some of them are held only for a little period in detention and then moved to the Navetirtsa, which is for women. But for the kids, it's more common to keep those kids in detention centers and not send them, more than the females.
Are there a lot of women prisoners?
There's about 70 right now.
Yeah. And are they subjected to the same kinds of tortures? Or?
Yes, in interrogation. Now, the torture thing, it's not what they've been using these in the last few years. It's not... they're like forbidden from sleeping for 3 to 4 days, sometimes 5 days, which is one way during the interrogation. The other way is always the Palestinian prisoners are, they cuff his hands behind his back during the interrogation. And interrogation can last for like 8 hours, 9 hours, 12 hours. So they're always in this position during the interrogation, and it applies for both men and women. And most of the Palestinian prisoners are beaten up before getting to the prison itself. When they arrest you in the house, from your house or in the street, the soldier beat up the prisoners, and mm-hmm. most of them reported
the women as well.
The women not beating. No, they more like threatened more than beating.
Do they allow the cross-gender interrogation? Yes. 13-year-old girl could be facing a 20-year-old man with a
yes.
gun and 10 of them.
In the arrest, we had a case for a woman in her 20s. I don't know exactly how old she is. She's called Fida Amira. She was arrested from her house, and the force that came to arrest her, it was all men and a big force. And even when they moved her from the house, and she was in the car, there was no a female soldier with them. It was all men. And I remember she told me it was really scary to be with all these men, soldiers, all for hours in the jeep. And they sent her to detention camp and then to Beit Il. And so she was a long time in the car with the men. And then she was sent to Al-Maskubiya. And the interrogator is a man. There is no a female interrogator. We had a case for a kid. His name is Munir Muslah, and he was 13 when he was arrested. And he was held in Beit Il detention camp. Beit Il is nearby Ramallah. And he was held there for 3 months. He was sentenced for throwing stones because other kids in the neighborhood said he threw stone. So the Israeli army came to the house and arrested the kid. Of course, a kid, if a soldier with like 18 soldier would get in your room with their guns and say you throw stone, you would say, yes, I throw stone, because you're scared. They're 13 and 14, they're kids. So other kids in the neighborhood said, who were arrested before him, said he was with us when we throw stones. And in the interrogation, they would ask you how many stones you throw. You would say 12, 50, and 60 stones. And in your sentence, it will be that you throw a number of stones. And because you throw stones, then you threaten a life of an Israeli who was in the in that street you throw stone at, or the soldier, you threaten their life by the stone. So they go to the house and arrested him, and he was sentenced for 3 months for throwing stone. And because they had no enough room to move him to the children prison, so he was kept in Beit Il with other adults. And in Beit Il, as I said about the detention center, it's very poor there. It's a very small room, and he said it was a very, very dirty room. And we have his affidavits if you would like to have it later on. He said it was dirty, and the mattress was very thin, and whenever he wants to sleep, he should bend his knees because the cell was so small. And it was like this for 3 months. In this condition with other Palestinians. he said it was very dear to you. We were not, the soldier in Beit Il asked us to do some cleaning in the kitchen and cleaning in the corridor. And whenever we don't want to clean, they would yell at us and they would forbid us from going to the in the afternoon for an hour for in the yard or they give them a small bottle to because they're not allowed to go to the toilet whenever they want, so they have this small bottle inside, so they would, you know.
And throughout this period, no visitation from family?
No.
What about visitation from representation? An attorney or someone who can represent them? Does the child have any?
We have visited him once when he was there, but from family, the families can't visit. So it was very tough for him to be there for 3 months. His family came here to the association and said he doesn't know that we're following up with a lawyer. He's there because they can't call him. There's no phones also there that they can, families can't call because there is no phone either in the detention camps or in the prisons. Prisoners, they don't have phone. Families can't call and they can't call families. So there is no phone, there is no visits, and he's only 13. And with other adults, and when he was released after that, and his mother came back, and I'm still in contact with that kid. And his mother told me his behavior changed a lot with his brother and with his friends. He's always scared whenever there's the Israeli army in his village, and he would just run from the street and hide in the house and say, and close the door and say, I'm not here if they ask about me. And he became more like violent kid. He would beat up his friends, his cousins, and it affected him because inside he's scared. And he would never tell anybody what exactly happened with him, what things, the details. He'd say, yeah, this happened, this and that, but exactly the details, he don't want to speak about it anymore. The last number we get for how many kids, there was 350 kids in the prisons. That's the last number we get this year. But it always change. Now I see the pictures broadcasted from Iraq, how they do the house-to-house search, the aggression in the face, how they get in the houses. For a moment, I don't know if it's in the West Bank or if it's in Iraq. It's the same pictures. You can never tell. For some seconds, you can never tell. They've been doing this for many years. They've been doing it since the 70s, what they're doing.
The plan for Iraq is to be like Palestine.
Now I see the pictures broadcasted from Iraq, how they do the house-to-house search, the aggression in the face, how they get in the houses. For a moment, I don't know if it's in the West Bank or if it's in Iraq. It's the same pictures. You can never tell. For some seconds, you can never tell. House-to-house search. House-to-house search. Now I see the pictures broadcasted from Iraq. House-to-house search. For a moment, I don't know if it's in the West Bank or if it's in Iraq. House-to-house search. They've been doing it since the 70s, is what they're doing.
The plan for Iraq is to be like Palestine. The plan for Iraq is to be like Palestine.
House-to-house search.